From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the most part, as a species, we humans have moved past the need to hunt. We've mostly figured out other ways to get our protein. But the scholar Jan Desard says there are still very good reasons for humans to hunt. There's a cultural importance to it. If it's done right, it can connect us to nature and place, and it can help us take responsibility for our food. But how does any of that square with the rich dentist who lures a lion off a game preserve, or someone who spends $350,000 to kill an endangered black rhino? When is it ethical to hunt an animal these days? When do you cross the line from being a predator stalking prey to a guy with a scope and a GPS exploiting a helpless creature? Really, the question is, why hunt? That's what we're asking after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I think we can distill the program today to one really basic question. Why do people hunt? It's a pretty deep question if you think about it. There are practical answers. Hunters say they hunt to get out in nature and connect with it, to remind themselves that they're also animals in a cycle. But if you set all of that aside, you get to this question. Why is the actual killing part so necessary? People are still raging about the killing of Cecil the lion, and trophy hunters are defending themselves. And the key argument is that hunting is a conservation tool, that without it, these animals would have no real value. Others tell us that hunting yields a deep connection to millions of years of human history, and that the killing part, that's a primal impulse. Today in the program, we're working through all of this, and we're hoping to hear from you. You can join us at 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Where are you on this question? If you do hunt, why do you hunt? There's a recent episode of the program Radio Lab that I think puts all of these questions in perspective. It's called The Rhino Hunter. It's really terrific. We'll put a link to it on our website. And this is where we're going to begin, with the producer who reported the story for Radio Lab, Simon Adler. And he's joining us today from the studios of WNYC in New York City. And Simon Adler, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, I want to begin your story. You really got started here in Salt Lake City. At least the story sort of, that's where it starts. At this, I guess it was at the gun show.
In
February.
Western, yeah. Correct. The Western Hunting and Conservation Expo back in February of this past year, or this year, correct.
So give us a sense, because you do this in the piece, of what you saw there at the gun show and what it sort of tells you about this story. Because, I mean, there's a lot of passion there. And it's interesting, I have to say, the language of people you heard there, you know, battle and fighting for a way of life, that was interesting.
Yeah, it was very much not what I expected. I'm from Wisconsin originally. I was raised around hunting, not in it. No one in my family really hunted, but I certainly had friends and family friends who hunted. So I was aware that there was this world of hunters, but didn't know too much about it. Got interested in this, went to this hunting expo, and was just kind of blown away by several aspects of it. First of all, this line I heard over and over again from these hunters and from the people operating the booths and the outfitters was, without us, these animals just wouldn't be here.
Right.
Without hunters, without hunter conservationists, these animals wouldn't be here. And the other piece that I found extremely surprising was how just the rhetoric that was surrounding all of this. It became very political for a lot of people, or it was very political for a lot of people, and just the level of strong language and that sense that the hunter conservationists of America are under attack, all of those things were really surprising to me.
So you came here to Salt Lake to talk to one man in particular, Corey Knowlton. And let's explain who he is, because in your piece you describe him sort of as the poster child for this idea of the hunter as a conservationist.
Yeah, I think he well, Corey Knowlton, he's from a Texas oil family. He's been a hunter all his life, started guiding hunts internationally at a pretty young age, in his early 20s. And while he was out there guiding these hunts through these various parts of the world, he started to kind of have this change of consciousness. This new perspective on it all, seeing that these wild places were disappearing, seeing these kind of untouched corners of the globe that he was worried weren't going to be here for too much longer. And so he, through my conversations with him, he expressed that he kind of had this switch in his mindset where he went from being just a hunter to really becoming a hunter conservationist. And I guess I think it's fair to consider him the poster child of this idea of hunter conservationism. Because he really, when he bought this black rhino tag, this opportunity to go shoot a black rhino in Namibia, he really came under a lot of fire, had the opportunity to back down, and very much said, "No, I'm really gonna put myself in this. I believe in this. I'm going to stand firm in this." And he was all over the media, taking interviews with just about anybody who would talk to him, kind of laying out the hunter conservationist manifesto, if you will.
You know, I really liked him, I have to say, which I was a little surprised by. I mean, like, he's no Ted Nugent. He's kind of a good old boy, but he's also really thoughtful. He's really smart. With you, he was deeply emotional at times and really passionate, too. But he's a really likable character.
Yeah, he was incredibly kind to me during every phase of the process. He was very open with me about just about anything in his life that I wanted to know about. And at least for me, it was really good to, and I think we strive to accomplish this in the piece, to humanize these oftentimes demonized individuals. Yes, he is a very wealthy man. Yes, a lot of his political views might not be exactly the same as mine. But we had a lot in common, it turned out, and we were very much able to relate with one another and understand each other, which I was very thankful the entire way for that opportunity and to him for being so so open and willing.
Yeah. I want to play a moment from your piece. And I think this is kind of where you get to that really big question, you know, why it is that people hunt. And essentially, the way you lead into it, as we'll hear, is, you know, you're saying, look, other people are saying you're just this rich guy who can afford to go out on these kinds of things, and, you know, he's sort of questioning his motives. But it does get to that basic question. Let me play this clip, and then we can talk about it.
Sure, I enjoy the act of hunting. Can I tell you why? Could I wrap that up in a real pretty burrito for you to be able to eat and understand and it tastes good? No, but I can tell you that I care about the survival of these species.
And do you understand why people have a hard time wrapping their mind around that, you believing that, and simultaneously wanting to kill an animal? Or does it not compute to you at all?
I mean, at what point we're getting redundant? They're missing the whole boat. We don't have one without the other, okay? If we want wildlife to be around for future generations, we have to understand that that wildlife has to have a value. If it doesn't have a value, especially in the continent of Africa, it's going to be gone.
So we'll come back to this question of whether or not hunters or conservationists in a second. But do you think you got a good answer, Simon, to that question of why it is people hunt? I mean, because it's interesting in that clip how Corey says, I can't really wrap this up in a bow for you. I can't really explain it. I mean, do you think that's the answer, that it's difficult to explain why it is people like to hunt?
Well, I think it is incredibly difficult to explain. I think it's a very individual answer.
Yeah.
One person could say something completely different from the other. But I think what I was pushing at on him there, and to which he responded to, was like, this is a paradox. It's an intellectual paradox. This idea that you want something to be around, but yet you want to be able to blot it off the face of the earth, one of them. So it becomes an issue of scale. It becomes really, really complicated, which is why I think it was such a fun question and topic to explore.
What do you think you understand about – because this was – you deal with this a bit in the piece – the reaction from the public or people who were opposed to this. I mean, really not just emotional and not just intense, but at times really violent, kind of ugly, the reaction.
Yeah, I think that is almost as complex as the act of hunting in the name of conservation. Yeah. I think there are several things at play there. First of all, I think there is a moral belief that killing animals is wrong. Yeah. And I think there's moral ground to stand on there. I don't think there I can appreciate that. I was a vegetarian for 8 years, so I appreciate that and I understand that. I think also what we have been sold as the image of conservation isn't totally true, and I think that confuses things at times. I talk to lots of different conservation organizations, and there's this idea that a lot of them come back to of charismatic megafauna, right, which is basically these large, beautiful mammals that when we see, we somehow emotionally attach to. So they've realized, lots of conservation organizations have realized, that this is a great way to get people to care about conservation, get you and I to care about one individual animal. If we're talking about global warming, we're not going to talk about necessarily ice caps melting. We're going to talk about this one polar bear. Mm. And we have been sold this idea that, well, then conservation must be saving that one animal, when in fact it's something far, far more far larger and far more complex than that. So I think that's where some of the misunderstanding surrounding hunting and conservation comes in. Yeah. I think that's part of why people become upset, but I think even larger than that is it's just there's a moral opposition to it.
You mentioned that if you look at the numbers from Namibia, for example, they show that this idea of hunting as conservation seems to actually be working, and you kind of work through those numbers. But of course, there's also another side that you explore in the piece, and not everyone agrees with this idea that hunting is you know, crucial for conservation. I want to play a clip from Richard Leakey. You talked to him for the piece. He's this famous conservationist anthropologist, spent his life in Kenya. Let me play this clip because he told you this idea that you have to hunt animals to protect them. Here's his words. He said, utterly ridiculous.
You know, if a father can't afford to pay school fees for his children, does he say to somebody, you can rape my daughter so I can get the money to pay for her school fees? I mean, I think we've got to set some standards in life, and I think this is nonsense what this argument is about. Killing wild animals so that they can be looked after absolutely sends the wrong message.
I wanted to ask you about that because Leakey, what I found interesting about this part of the piece is that Leakey isn't just making an appeal in emotional terms. The argument he's making isn't just an ethical one, although that's a big one, but it's also practical. And what he seems to have figured out, or this is the argument he makes anyway, is that you don't tackle the supply side, you go after the demand side of this. Would you talk about this? Because I think this is an important argument.
Sure. Let me quickly lay out the Corey's argument,
yeah,
economic argument about
right.
this, that basically it's very costly to live near a black rhino. If you are an individual living in Namibia, you don't want to live near a black rhino. It has a negative cost. There on the ledger, it's all in the red. So you need to somehow incentivize those individuals to not just get rid of all of those animals. One way you do that is you have wealthy Westerners come over and shoot a few of them. That money then trickles back down into the community through various ways.
Right.
That's his argument. And he's saying that therefore, by putting that dollar value on it, that rhino has a net positive and therefore will be kept around. Now what Leakey's argument is that may be true on that individual level, but what is the damage that you're doing to public perception by allowing one wealthy Westerner to come over here? Because in most media, that's just going to come across as, oh, well, there are enough of them that we can shoot them. There are enough of them that we can be auctioning them off. And he's saying, if you cost out the damage to public perception, if you cost out how that's going to affect money flowing into conservation organizations, that money being the government feeling like it has a mandate to do something about conservation, that actually having one guy like Corey Knowlton come in and shoot a black rhino is actually a net negative to black rhinos in general. And it's a great argument. It's a really, really interesting argument. And I haven't seen – nobody has done numbers. Nobody has data on that I was able to find. But it makes sense that very well could be true.
Yeah. What he's saying, it seems, also is that people have to learn to value these animals beyond their economic value. And this is how you put it in the piece. You say they have to learn to respect the intrinsic value of these animals.
Right.
Is that the key for Leakey and for other conservationists, to seeing them beyond, you know, a trophy, but just intrinsically seeing them for valuing them for just their place in nature, I guess?
Yes. They would say that these animals do have an intrinsic value. I would argue that a lot of hunter conservationists probably would argue the same thing.
Right.
But yeah, Leakey's also saying that this is – if we're going to look at these animals in purely market terms, you have to appreciate that markets are incredibly volatile. And the value of that black rhino, for one reason or another, could crash overnight. And then you have no incentive to keep them around. So purely keeping them around for economic reasons is a dangerous bet in the long term, according to Leakey. And unless we are able to value them on some more intrinsic a more intrinsic level where it's not good. It's not likely that these animals will be around for the great future.
Well, and he also talks about, and it seems like the stakes are pretty high in the sense that things are changing in the sense that more and more people are living in cities. He points out this younger generation. I think this is something you point out in the piece. Mm-hmm. This younger generation seems less and less inclined to give to conservation causes. So getting the right message, as Leakey puts it in the piece, is more and more important.
Totally agreed. Yeah, it's we are, whether we like it or not, we are at this kind of incredible moment in human history, certainly in the history of the planet. Geologists are calling it the Anthropocene at the moment. Because we are the greatest force shaping the planet. That's incredible, good, bad, or otherwise. So I think it is really important for the right messaging to be put out. I also think that practical solutions in the moment are also needed, and I think that's why this is so gosh darn complicated.
Yeah,
yeah.
Let me play one more piece. This is near the end of the piece that you produced, and Corey's making this case that hunting, as he puts it, is just part of being human. And Robert Krulwich, at this part, kind of pushes back on that.
I'm not really morally outraged by it. Maybe I am a little, but I think you might be vulnerable if you insist that your enthusiasm for hunting is part of the balance of nature. But I think it's
Robert,
a perfectly...
you don't have those canine teeth for eating salad. And I understand that people don't like it any more than they wouldn't like going and killing the lamb of the lamb chops they eat.
Well,
that it's wrong. Hunting, it's part of who we are. Now, it may be a bigger part of who I am than you are, and that's fine. But when wildlife populations abound is when they're managed by human beings.
So Corey's being a realist, he says. I'm a realist. And all this other talk is just kind of sounds good, but it doesn't really work. I guess I wanted to ask what you finally, I think, learned about all of this from doing the piece. And maybe it was just reflected in what you said before we played that clip, which is it's really complicated. But what do you think you learned about all of that?
I guess where I fall at the end of the day is I think that trophy hunting probably is – well, no, I think the numbers show that trophy hunting is an effective tool when done properly. Do I think that that's the end-all be-all? No. But is it a tool in the conservation toolbox that has been used effectively and should probably continue to be used effectively? The numbers, a lot of numbers say it is. If you zoom out from that, does that make this scheme seem problematic? Yes. So we're in this strange moment where we need practical solutions. We need pragmatic solutions right in the here and the now, but I think we simultaneously need to be really critically thinking about this and come up with ways that maybe are safer in the long run.
It's Simon Adler. He's a producer for the show Radiolab on radio station WNYC in New York City. We have a link to this piece on our website. It's called The Rhino Hunter. And Simon joined us from the studios of WNYC. Simon, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
801-585-WEST, our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking why people hunt, which is a big question. If you set aside the practical stuff, the meat, the connection to nature, you get to the question of why the actual killing part is so necessary. We've been talking earlier with Simon Adler, producer for the program Radio Lab. He's produced a really great piece called The Rhino Hunter. As I said, we'll put it on our website. Joining us now is Jan Desard, who is the Charles Hamilton Houston Professor in American Culture at Amherst College. He's the author of several books about hunting, including Mortal Stakes, Hunters and Hunting in Contemporary America. He's joining us from a studio in Pelham, Massachusetts. Jan Desard, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Happy to be here.
David Peterson is also with us throughout the hour, author of many books about hunting, including Heart's Blood and Ghost Grizzlies. His newest is Going Trad. He's also the subject of a new documentary film called On the Wild Edge, Hunting for a Natural Life. We have links to all of that on our website. David Peterson is joining us from from radio station KDUR on the campus of Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado. And David Peterson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Happy to be here.
So I guess we should start with the most sort of basic question. And Jan Desard, to you first, you know, why is it that people hunt? You've spent a lot of time writing about this, and we can talk about some of the particulars, but is there a way of distilling it down to one really succinct answer?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Certainly not one succinct answer. Because the reasons, the motivations are quite varied. I wouldn't say that everyone is uniquely drawn to hunting. I mean, there are patterns, obviously.
Yeah.
One important one of which, of course, is tradition. My grandfather hunted. I'm not speaking about myself, by
right.
the way.
Yeah.
But grandfather and father and older brother, and it's just it's almost a ritual for many hunters. Now, that's getting less and less the case
right.
in the United States, in part because the transmission belt from senior males to junior males has been weakened by a number of forces that we may get into, but I won't touch that now. So that's one motive. There a more recent motive is accounting for the entrance of new people with no hunting experience, no tradition to draw upon. Who are interested in knowing where their food comes from
yeah.
and who are, in one way or another, distrustful of industrial agriculture and neatly processed and packaged meat at the meat counter. And they are curious about providing for themselves and knowing where their food comes from. And that's not a huge movement now, but it is certainly statistically recognizable in many recent and current surveys of what brings people to hunting. So it's a mixture of motives, if you will. It's a mixture of aspirations that get wrapped up. And of course, some would argue that it's instinctual, that
yeah.
we were hunter-gatherers for thousands and thousands of years, and that some part of our genetic code draws us to that. I'm skeptical of the genetic argument, quite frankly. I would be less skeptical if every time autumn rolls around, people start sharpening sticks and so on. That obviously doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So I think it's a learned behavior. It's a culturally transmitted behavior.
But not embedded in our genes, you don't think?
I don't think so.
Huh.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff embedded in our genes that make us capable of being rocket scientists. Some of us, not me, God, Lord knows. But, yeah, genes are a complicated thing. And I don't think that one can attribute behavior, whether it's admirable saintly behavior or murderous behavior or what have you, to simple genes. Culture is really the dominant factor here. In the interest of disclosure, I should say that I'm a professional sociologist, so
right.
I'm sort of predisposed, if not genetically at least,
to look at it that way,
by acquired culture, to be skeptical about genetic explanation.
Got it. Well, David Peterson, what about you? And I know this is really personal for you. When people ask why you hunt, have you come up with a sort of a nice, tidy answer?
No, I'm not known for tidiness. I've written countless magazine articles and several books trying to address all of this from various angles, and I'm still working on it. And, writing is a self-education process, so I'm still learning myself. But it is deeply personal. And for me, why I hunt, many reasons, but it's just part of the lifestyle that I've come to embrace, which is what I call good work. That is, I would rather be a generalist and do as much for myself as I can than to be a specialist, which is what our culture pushes us into, and do your thing and pay someone else to do everything else. So I built my own cabin. I cut all my own firewood every year. And for 30-some years, I've gotten in the bulk of the meat for my wife and I. It's just all part of the picture, and I think it's done well, done respectfully. I think it's just a really enriching part of my life.
I wonder if you have a theory, being out there like you are. Do you feel any sort of genetic, biological tinge when you're out hunting? I know. So Jan Desard might be skeptical of whether or not there's a genetic component here. Do you feel like it's embedded in your biology to hunt?
Well, I agree, first of all, with Jan's skepticism. But, yeah, I've actually said, I don't know how else to explain the urge. I did not grow up in a hunting family. My father was a workaholic. He just didn't have time, and he never hunted as a kid. And I had to scratch around to find adults that would haul me out somewhere where I could hunt. But hunting, fishing, Boy Scouts, backpacking, all of that, they were just in me right from the beginning. And I don't know how they got there. I think there's a halfway ground that biologists call predisposition. That is, we are biologically or genetically predisposed to want to do certain things. That doesn't mean by any means that we're obligated or required to do those things in some internal driven way. But I don't know how else to explain being born with this urge to do all things wild and be out there. And later on, hunting led me to become a naturalist and led me to become a conservationist. I think those are very positive things in anyone's life. So it's been a net good for me, although I really detest what's happening to it.
Yeah, which we'll get to. So I get,
please,
of course.
Yeah, I think the biography of David is interesting, and my biography, I was a sickly child. I had polio, among other things, and yearned to be autonomous and independent when I was anything but. And I, as a child, I was reading, because I was basically bedbound, I was reading adventure stories of pioneers and trappers out west and so on, along with reading the adventure stories of leading scientists of the 18th and 19th century, and I could never figure out which I wanted to be. Did I want to be a scientist or a trapper? The scientist sort of won,
yeah.
Social science,
yeah.
But I never lost that interest and that intrigue about camping in the woods and being self-reliant. And I think self-reliance as a motif, particularly in American culture, is a very strong component of most hunters. and not exclusively hunters. I mean, self-reliance, the do-it-yourself movement that was so popular in the 50s and 60s and still goes on, is all part of this, what David, I think, would properly describe as a resistance to the culture of specialization and so on. And hunting is one of the quintessential elements, I would add gardening, by the way, in which you take a seed or an idea or a plan of your own creation and bring it to fruition. And the fruition is the hunt and the kill, or in the garden, the harvest. And I think that complete circle is extraordinarily gratifying to more and more people, particularly since their workaday lives are rarely complete circles. They're completely fragmented.
Yeah. Here's a question from Michael. It comes via our Facebook. He says, the question should be, why do people get a thrill out of killing? All the interviews I see and read talk about the conservation, the challenge, being in nature, all those kinds of things. But every person defending hunting talks of the thrill of killing, which, and the rest, he says, just seems like justification. And he gets to a good question I want to ask you both about. So I understand the thrill of the chase. I understand the physical and mental challenge of stalking prey. I understand how it even might be primal. You know, gets you out and nature, all of those kinds. What I don't know if I understand is the killing part, how the kill has to be necessary to the experience. Now, for David, the kill is necessary to get the meat. I understand that. But I wanted you to sort of talk about how, because this is something, Jan Desaud, maybe we should start with you, because what you've talked about is there's a difference between hunting and hiking. It's not just you're more attuned, you're doing it differently. Would you talk a little bit about that? Why is the pulling the trigger part so necessary to this experience?
Well, I don't think it's necessary to the experience in the sense that it has to be, quote, successful, unquote. That is to say that there has to be a kill at the end of the day. It's the being prepared to take the life of an animal, whether or not you actually do on any given outing. And to be perfectly honest, most hunters most of the time come home empty-handed, though they come home with all kinds of good feelings and experiences and so on that they're more than happy to share with others. So I think it's the preparation, the mental preparation to be ready to kill if the opportunity presents itself. That marks hunting off from photography, for example, or hiking. And you can go back and read Thoreau in Walden, and he will talk about how hunting exaggerated his senses. He was more perceptive, more attuned to sounds and sights and smells. That didn't mean that he thought in the end that hunting was great. He thought that if he were alive today, I'm sure he'd say every young child should experience hunting and then grow out of it, and in his words, this is a paraphrase, and then take up a sketchbook and a notepad and reflect on nature in a different form. But there was something even for him about hunting that elevated the sensuality of being human and our human senses.
David,
I think that's what's crucial. I don't think most hunters, certainly not most hunters that I've interviewed or that I know personally and have hunted with, talk about the thrill of the kill. It's much more nuanced and there's much more ambivalence involved. It's as I say in the mean to say in the title of my book, these are mortal stakes, and it the emotional aura surrounding the successful kill, whether it's of an elk or of a rough grouse. I'm a grouse hunter. David's an elk hunter. There's an overwhelming sense, not of thrill, but of simultaneous remorse and satisfaction. Thrill seeking, there are better ways to engage in thrill seeking than hunting. Much more ambivalent, unambivalent thrills available to us.
Yeah.
So I think the thrill is misplaced.
Yeah. David Peterson, what do you think?
Well, once again, I'm right in tune with Jan. I don't know who the caller Michael has been speaking to, and with all due respect, but I've never heard a single person, a single hunter that I associate with, nor even, well, I don't read the, what I call horn porn magazine, so I don't know what they're doing there. No one I know talks about the thrill of the kill. It's just a foreign concept to me, and so I'm not sure where he got that information. So I would disagree to begin with the concept that most hunters talk about the thrill of the kill. If anything, it's just the opposite. Let's say less thoughtful hunters are, they'll yell and scream and hoot and holler. It's sort of like winning the football game. They've gone out and taken on a challenge, and they've won, and that's the way they know how to react to it. It probably has really no respect or disrespect for the animal. But most thoughtful hunters, the kind that I generally have encountered, there's remorse there. It's a really tough time. I don't know anyone that enjoys the kill. You enjoy accomplishing a hard-won project. That's where the satisfaction comes from. Thrill is just out of the ballpark. There cannot be a hunt. It's not like catch and release fishing. There can't be a hunt without the kill. And most people don't kill most of the time. Let me give you a quick personal example here that may help illustrate this. I am an elk hunter, and that's what I have. If I had whitetails, I'd be a whitetail hunter, but I'm a meat hunter.
Yeah.
But I love the process of hunting. I just love being the greatest hunt for me is I can come home in the evening and know absolutely that nothing knew I was there. I feel like that's the deepest immersion you can get in nature, and nothing else can provide that. I love to hunt big bull elk because they're far fewer, they're far more difficult to hunt, and there's this acoustical vocal aspect they love to sing in the fall when archery season, which is what I hunt. But when it comes to the killing, I almost always will kill the first animal that presents itself with a good shot opportunity that I know I can make a quick, humane kill. If it's a bull, all the better. If it's a young cow, well, my wife always loved the young cows better because it's better meat. So I hope that, I mean, the thrill of the chase for the big bull is there, and I pursue it. But when it comes down to it, I'm just out there for meat, and I take whatever comes in.
Here's something that comes from Ben, who writes, a lot of non-hunters seem to think that hunting is about the so-called thrill of the kill. As a passionate hunter, I take the killing part of hunting very seriously. I weep, he says, every time I take the life of a big animal like an elk. I don't cry, though, he says, when I harvest fish from the stream, another kind of hunting. And I often wonder whether people who call hunters out for their bloodlust are meat eaters, because if they are, they're ignorant and hypocritical. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We have with us Jan Desard. He's a professor of sociology at Amherst College and the author of several books about hunting. David Peterson is also with us, a conservationist and outdoorsman, author of several books also about hunting. We need to take a break, though, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about why it is people hunt. Like, deep down, what's the essential reason that people hunt? Beyond the wanting to be outside, beyond the wanting the meat, and all of that may be enough, but is there something primal about it? Is there something cultural about it? Jan Desard is with us, a professor of sociology at Amherst College. He is the author of a number of books, including Mortal Stakes, Hunters and Hunting in Contemporary America. We also have David Peterson with us, author of a number of books as well, Heart's Blood among them. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Let's take a few calls. Lisa has been waiting in Salt Lake City. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you. My first comment is that we have removed most of the predators from the population of deer and elk, and left ourselves with the responsibility of being predators to keep them from starving to death, which just breaks my heart in the winter. I have hunted since I was 8 years old. I am no longer physically capable of hunting, which I miss dreadfully because I enjoy both venison and elk. And we always hunted, butchered, and froze our own meat. It was an every year event in our family. And it's something I miss terrifically. And we always, always apologize to the animal whose life we took and thank them for the meat.
Well, Jan Desard, so there in Lisa is, so there are two things going on. She mentioned, I think she really confirmed your idea that this is a cultural, traditional thing embedded in the culture of humans, clearly that. But she also raises that question first off, and that is the big question about whether hunting is crucial for conservation. Would you go to that point, the idea that we as humans have sort of upset the natural balance of things, so we have to step in and play the role of predators, to cull the herds, those kinds of things? What do you say to that?
Well, this is an interesting issue, and it plays out very differently in Africa. The first 20 minutes of the program, of course, was devoted to the famous or infamous rhino hunt.
Yeah.
Very differently in Africa than in Europe, for example, or in North America. The fact is that the management of wildlife in the United States, and we can include Canada here as well, was designed in effect in an era of scarcity of game. And not just, by the way, not just of, you know, iconic game animals like deer and elk, but yeah. But all kinds of wildlife, including neotropical birds with feathers that were attractive for the millinery trade at the turn of the century. That market hunting for a profit, had driven most animals, wildlife species, or many wildlife species at any rate, to the brink of extinction. And sport hunters came to the rescue, and were the bulwark of the late 19th, early 20th century conservation movement, that not only was attempting to restore wildlife populations, but also to restore and improve the habitat that wildlife depended upon. And so there was a crucial role that was played by hunters and fishermen, and indeed by socially prominent women urging other women not to succumb to the temptations of a beautifully feathered hat or boa. Today, the issue is somewhat different, mostly because of the success of that early 20th century conservation movement. Now we have, in many places of the country, certainly here in southern New England, we have way too many deer, not only too many, but they're also in places that are not really suitable for hunting. They have become suburban lawn ornaments. And so on. And that poses a very different conservation challenge that frankly, it's not clear that recreational or sport hunting is up to the task, in part because you can't shoot safely in suburban settings.
Right.
So there's an evolution, but certainly there's no question but what hunters and fishers are owed a great debt of gratitude for basically producing a really seriously robust retinue of wildlife species, and again, not just game animals.
Yeah, I think David Peterson, you agree with that in principle, but to the idea, when you hear a hunter say, "I hunt for conservation purposes," you're skeptical.
Yes, and you made that distinction quite clear there. I agree with everything Dan has said, it's mostly in the historical context, Court. I am not sure that we couldn't come up with a different paradigm moving forward, but for an individual hunter to try to justify, you know, going out and killing a deer for conservation, I find ludicrous. They're just...
I agree, David.
Okay.
I was talking about the collective impact of
yeah, and that's the distinction that yes. Yeah, we're in agreement there, and the fact that we need hunting now to control the game populations that hunters have helped reestablish after market hunters almost destroyed, that's the tradition, that's the system in all the states. It would be very hard to turn that battleship. But I would not go as far as to say that there is no other way to manage wildlife short of hunting. I think hunting is the best tool we have for it, and also takes it out of the realm of just professionals and kind of brings it closer to home, makes it more democratic.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Dave has been waiting in Salt Lake City. Dave, hi.
Hey. Yeah, I like to hunt because I think it's given me valuable insight into human nature. And I like the personal challenge, particularly with big game. You know, I hunt on foot, and my buddy and I have to pack out whatever, a 500-pound elk. And I've gained a lot of insight into myself.
Jandisar, what do you say about that? This, because this is something that I think it's a point you make, that hunting sort of gives us a sense of who we are. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, hunting is done properly is a test, and by done properly, I mean, you know, not some canned situation, yeah, where a so-called hunter is put down at a stand and the deer are trained by a feeding machine to come at a certain hour when the pellets are being dispensed, and then he's, you know, he plunks one.
Yeah. And that happens.
Yes, it happens.
Yeah.
fortunately, it's not typical, but yeah, it happens. That indeed, as the caller indicates, you do learn things about yourself. You learn things, you know, your limits. You also learn things about the way you change over time, and the way that the places that you hunt change over time. This sense of rootedness in an ongoing ecological and life cycle sense is really captured like nothing else that I can think of,
yeah,
by the experience of hunting. I would add fishing in that mix too, but I think hunting more vividly. So you learn your limits, not just your physical limits, but your perceptual limits, et cetera, in ways that I think are hard to replicate in other kinds of activities.
I want to get to the question of trophy hunting before we run out of time. Let me read a few more comments before we head that way, though. Ryan writes, this is about perspective. I'm sure hunting has its positive points if you're myopic, but he says, its complexion would change dramatically if we were bumped a notch or two lower on the food chain and became the hunted. Then those tough hunters would be scared because fear and suffering is not a desirable state of being. Tyler writes, as a vegan, I find moral outrage over trophy hunting ironic. I think trophy hunting is more ethical than factory farming, where most people get their meat. At least the animals have a good natural life up until they die, unlike the billions of animals raised in hellish conditions on factory farms. Scott writes, I think the main difference between shooting a deer or a similar animal and shooting a rhino or a similar animal is the abundance of the animal. Around here, he writes, if we didn't hunt the deer, they would overrun the valley. On the other hand, mountain lions are much more scarce, and while the need to still be managed, shooting one is a bigger deal. Which I think gets us to the question of trophy hunting. The idea of getting a guide, a professional hunter, to meet you at the airport, take you out, and find a black rhino in a field. David Peterson, this clearly bothers you. What do you say to this idea of trophy hunting?
Well, first of all, there's nothing in the conversation about hunting that's simple. And we could take any one of these questions and talk the whole hour and not exhaust the possibilities.
Yeah.
So, definition, what do we mean by trophy hunting? And it means something different to different people. As far as the black rhino or going to Africa to shoot anything or shooting animals, captive animals on a game farm, I find it absolutely abhorrent. Cecil the Lion, I was really upset that none of the news media got around to the motivation, the morality of what would make a person want to do something like that. On the other hand, like I said, if I go out hunting for elk, I'm hoping every day that I bring home a nice big bull. I'll have the satisfaction of that extra effort. I love the antlers. I see them as art, and the meat is still meat. I think the majority of typical American hunters would tell you when they go out hunting the first day, you know, they would love nothing better than to bring home something that they could consider a trophy. On the other hand, the majority of them do what I do. They kill the first legal animal that comes in. So it's not a big follow-through idea. So as far as hiring guides and flying around the world, and especially an increasing number of these animals in Africa and here, are captive animals to one degree or another. They're captive raised. I just find it morally abhorrent, and I wish it didn't exist, and it's not even hunting as far as I'm concerned.
Jen Desard, how are you thinking about it?
Well, you know, I think the question of whether it's hunting or not, as opposed to shooting, is a good question. With respect to the single instance of the black rhino, which I think is, by the way, different than the episode with Cecil, the black rhino was targeted and picked out by wildlife professionals. It was past the breeding age.
Yeah.
It was supernumerary. It was very near the end of its natural life.
It's pretty dangerous to the other rhinos, I guess, too.
Yeah, and the $300,000, I don't know how much of it actually went to Namibia and to their wildlife management officials. But my guess is that a fairly significant portion of that went to the Namibian game protection business. So I think that's a different kind of thing. I wouldn't even dream of doing it, even if I had $350,000 to drop on such an enterprise. But I think that's different than the, you know, going out to get a life list and to hang another exotic animal's head or horns or antlers on your man cave den. I agree with David. That's just aberrant. I don't know what motivates that.
Jan Desard, professor of sociology at Amherst College, author of several books about hunting. Jan Desard, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Doug.
And David Peterson, conservationist, outdoorsman, author of several books as well, joined us from Durango, Colorado. David, thanks to you.
Hi, welcome. Now go home and get ready to go hunting.
Okay, good. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.